And we're going to talk science with our science guy, Sean Duke. Very good morning to you, Sean.
Hi, Angus. How are you?
Good, thank you. And as ever, you have some very interesting topics lined up. I don't know where to start. I teased a few of them before the break. Marriage helps cancer survival, apparently, so I'm told. But let's start with space exploration, because we've reached an important milestone this year, haven't we?
That's right. It's 55 years since Yuri Gagarin, the Soviet astronaut, went on his orbit around the Earth. So that was the 12th of April in 1961, 55 years ago. So at the time, this was absolutely huge, and it really stunned the world, because these were the days when, you know, the Western world didn't really know what the Soviet world was up to. So this was suddenly announced. People thought it was a hoax, perhaps, or propaganda, but it turned out it was true. And of course, this set off the US and got them into action, because they were fearing if the Soviets were in space, we need to be there too. And JFK made his famous speech that we have to put a man on the moon, etc. So I suppose it's a good time to kind of look at where we are, where we've come from over those 55 years. I suppose one of the big things is that it was highly politicized space when exploration started, because it was the Cold War, the early 60s. The Soviet Union and the USA were at each other's throats, and there was very little cooperation. It was the space race, it was called. Get to the moon first. Things changed over time. There was a bit of a thaw in the 1970s, when some people may remember the Apollo missions were linked with the Soyuz missions, and these famous link-ups between the Americans and the Soviets in space. And that really set us off on this international cooperation effort in space, because it's a massive task. It's so expensive to get people, or even missions without people up there, that you really need technology, need cooperation from all over the world. And what we're looking at now is a mission to Mars is the next big thing on the horizon in the 2030s, according to President Obama. The Russians have said, the Russian Space Agency have said recently, they want to set up an orbital space station going around Mars. There's also talk now of a return to the moon, and to set up a lunar base there and an orbital station too, as a base to explore the universe. And it's interesting to note that the last man on the moon, it's an incredibly long time ago now, was Eugene Cernan. We all know the first man, Neil Armstrong, but Eugene Cernan, C-E-R-N-A-N, December 1972. So this year, later this year, that'll be 44 years since a man set foot on the moon. Eugene is still alive, by the way. He's 82. So yeah, that's a quick summary of where we're at.
And it's amazing that we haven't been back to the moon in that time. Was it, we did it to prove we could do it, but do we have any need to go back at this stage? Why would we go back?
Yeah, you see, that's a very good question, because I think what drove it initially was fear that JFK went to Congress and he basically said, look, if we're not up in space, the Soviets are going to dominate us. So they threw money at it, and we're going to get there by the end of the decade and all of this. And the Americans did it. So then from 69 to 72, there were all these Apollo missions, and then they essentially did it all. They were around the moon. And then after that, there wasn't really so much of a drive to put men into space. because they'd achieved what they wanted to achieve, and these things are very expensive. So the whole thing just died away, and there was no real reason to do it, if you like. So now what's happening now, the big picture, is that the private companies, private entities and companies, Virgin, of course, has these planes up in the upper orbit. These private entities and companies are going to go to places like the moon with some public money, but it'll be private money in it, to do things like look for minerals, mining, to basically, it'll be like, maybe the Wild West in the US all those years ago. It's like this open territory where business may go there for different reasons. So it won't be done by governments as much in the future. It'll be done by industry. And maybe that's the reason for it.
And what I'm fascinated to find out, Sean, you mentioned there Richard Branson and other companies, they're going to be starting these private trips where people can pay hundreds of thousands of euro to fly to travel outside the atmosphere and into space. How long do you think it will be before that's within the reach of the common man, you or I, where we don't have hundreds of thousands of euro, where we might actually be able to get into space ourselves, the average person?
Yeah, well, the target, I mentioned the moon, but the only concrete target in terms of a manned mission is this mission to Mars, which the Russians and the Americans are both talking about. So that is going to happen, I think. Now, the 2030s, how long away is that? That's, could be 20 years at least. So that will be the astronauts getting there first, and they'll have to set up a mission, they'll have to develop that. I mean, it could be another 40 or 50 years before you have kind of the first people who'll probably be very wealthy people who will get the opportunity to go to the Mars or to go to the moon. So I don't know what age you are, but if you hang around maybe into your 80s or your 90s, you might make it, but it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Oh, fair enough. Well, I'll cling on as long as I can for that cheap trip into space. Right, we'll leave space there. We'll come back to Earth now. And a new study shows that some people are resistant to genetic diseases. And although they can carry markers, they can still avoid causing serious problems.
Yeah, now this is Cystic Fibrosis Week, so it kind of ties in with that as a news story. Cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease. There's a CF gene, or a gene that was found way back in 1989 that is linked with cystic fibrosis, and we have a very high instance of it here. So it's an example of how genetic diseases can be very serious, long-term, life-changing, etc. But what's just been published is a very interesting one, because they looked at the DNA, scientists looked at the DNA of 600,000 people, a lot of people that were, not necessarily susceptible to genetic disease. Some of them were. But they found in that group 13 people who essentially had the gene for cystic fibrosis, but they didn't have the disease. So they had two copies of a very rare mutation, which would normally, overwhelmingly up to now, always cause cystic fibrosis, the disease. But these 13 people didn't have it. So the question is why? Because if we can find out, why those 13 didn't show the symptoms of cystic fibrosis, this may give us, perhaps in the future, some way of tackling it. Now, the scientists, it's early days. They've just found these genetic superheroes, they're calling them, these 13 people that have showed up with this resistance. But what they really need to do, and this is the way science is going anyway, because they're so rare, there's so few of these people, 13 out of 100,000 after all, what they need is to pool the research scientific effort all around the world, and maybe have input from Ireland into studies in America and linked everywhere, so that we can get, perhaps millions of people involved to identify more of these genetic superheroes and to really study them in detail and find out what is it that they have that we can learn from to try and tackle something like CF. So I just thought it was an interesting cause for hope there.
Indeed. And another interesting article that we're going to talk about now. Married cancer patients more likely to survive than those who do not have the support of a loved one or a spouse during their battle with the illness. I'd say we're all not surprised that the support of another person helps you during an illness, but the fact that it can help your survival.
Yeah, well, scientists and researchers, health researchers, have known for some time now that being married actually is protective. It's good for your health. And some might argue with that, but no, it is. On every measure, it seems to be good for your health. And the question is, why is it good for your health? And now they know that cancer death rates, they found that they're among unmarried patients, they're higher. And they've also found, added to that, that the difference is particularly marked among single men. So single men are particularly vulnerable when they suffer from cancer. And this was a huge study that was done. It was a study by the University of California, nearly 1 million people, 800,000 people, about 50% men, 50% women. And the scientists looked at this information, and they said that the key factor, as far as they're concerned, when they looked at the data, was the lack of social supports was what was causing problems for the single men with cancer. Because if you're married, generally speaking, you have the support of your family, you've got your extended family as well, and then your friends on top of that. If you're a single woman, you tend to have more social supports and friends than the single men. The single men can sometimes be the ones that are lacking in that family support, that friend support, and this affects their outcomes. So what the scientists have suggested is that doctors now, when they're treating cancer patients, that they should, as part of their normal questioning of the patient, getting their history, they should ask them, look, are you married or not? That's the obvious first question. And if they're not married, do they have anyone to care for them physically and emotionally, especially when they're going through the treatment? And if they don't, maybe they need some kind of a support. Now, the American study, there's one other thing here that's really interesting about this study, which was an American study, and it found that people born outside the United States, so this was California, so people primarily of Hispanic, Mexican origin or South American origin, that they did better than Native Americans in terms of their cancer survival factors. And again, the theory is that the Hispanics have stronger social networks together when they go in to live in Los Angeles or wherever it is. They stick together. They're more family orientated than the Native Americans. And this actually translates into better health and better outcomes when it comes to trying to fight cancer. So one of the questions was that the study wanted to find out, are married couples, they tend to be a little bit better off than single people, are they protected from cancer because they have a little bit more money, or is it something to do with the social support and the companionship? And I think this study finally nails that and says that the social support and the companionship is the critical thing that's going to help you survive cancer.
And it's interesting there to know, Sean, that the mental influence can have such a massive impact on the physical condition that is cancer.
Absolutely. You know that we tend to touch them in medicine, that the brain is one thing and psychiatry is one thing, and then, you know, cardiac stuff is another thing. But actually the whole entity that we are as humans, it's all linked. So, you know, if you're emotionally upset or things are going on in your life, there's studies to show that your immune system is not going to function as well as it should. So this is why people, if they're under stress or upset, maybe they've lost a spouse or something, they're more likely to themselves get illness. So yes, absolutely. This is just more evidence that it's all linked together.
Now, finally, Sean, another topic that should be good news to people here in Ireland, because there's research to suggest that future solar panels will generate energy from raindrops. So based on the climate and the prevailing conditions here in Ireland, we should be energy rich.
That's right. Yeah, this is fantastic news now if it can be confirmed here in Ireland, because this is a story that's coming out of China, and the Chinese, they've published this paper in a journal, so, you know, hopefully it's correct, that they've developed this new solar cell. So a solar cell is like a little kind of engineering device that converts the light of the sun into electrical energy. So they have this new solar cell that they say could be put into solar panels in the future, where you could take account of days when there's not much sun and when there's cloud cover. The issue is that the way solar panels work basically is that on days when the sun isn't shining, they use the stored energy that they've stored up in the days when the sun is shining. But that scientists have only got so far in terms of the amount of storage that they can build into these storage panels. So there's a limited amount. So in other words, if you've got a long period like in Ireland where you've got cloudy days for a couple of weeks, then you're going to use up your stored energy pretty quickly, and then your solar panels are not going to work very well. So is there a solution? Well, these Chinese researchers say that they've been able to create electricity in their solar panels with raindrops. And the way they've done this is through a thin layer of graphene. Now, graphene would be, we'd all remember a pencil that we had in school. If you mark your pencil on the paper, there's little bits and flecks that are left. That's because it's coming off in little sheets. So graphene is like that. It's a very thin material. And it's known for its ability to conduct electricity. So they've developed this one atom thick, it's only one atom thick, a tiny, tiny layer of graphene. And basically what they're doing is that the water, there's salt that's contained in the rain. We know that, can taste of salt sometimes. This can be split into positive and negative things called ions. And these positive and negative charges, natural charges in the salt, in the rainwater, can make graphene charged, can essentially charge it. And they can use this charge to essentially convert that charge into electricity. So without going into the science of it too much, it's a brilliant, ingenious way of actually taking the natural chemical makeup, if you like, raindrops, and using that to actually generate electricity on days when we don't have any sun. So bring it on, I say.
Bring it on. It's something to look forward to indeed. Sean Duke, the Science Guy, as always, thank you very much for some very interesting and engaging discussion. I look forward to speaking to you again soon.